Service. Ethics. Advocacy. Welcome to the AICPA Tax Section Podcast. The Tax Center provides guidance, information, and tax practice tools to support the three goals of the AICPA Tax Section Strategic Plan: practice support, professional standards and ethics, and Washington representation. The AICPA Tax Section Podcast is one more source of information on all things tax and tax-related. In this episode, William Stromson, Director of the AICPA Tax Division, will discuss current developments in tax law and practice.
Hello, this is Bill Stromson, a director with the AICPA Tax Team, with the Tax Section Audio Alert for February 6, 2009. This is part of our new series of biweekly podcasts to report tax law and tax practice developments to CPAs. These are based on emailed alerts that tax section members receive and that include hot links to the source materials that we refer to in this audio version. Please consider joining the tax section to take full advantage of our practice alerts. You can join online at aicpa.org/tax. Partnership tax return problems. Practitioners are going to have to spend additional time this year preparing partnership returns because of some new information reporting requirements. Questions 3 and 4 and the recently released instructions for Form 1065 require practitioners to provide some difficult-to-obtain information, including details of indirect owners of the partnership and of entities indirectly owned by the partnership. Practitioners will have to request information from clients, check through client files, and otherwise search for information about related parties to comply. And in some cases, this information may not even be obtainable. The IRS is collecting this information, although it has no immediate effect on tax liabilities, and practitioners are expected to provide it in order to sign returns that are correct and complete. Since the draft of the revised form came out in July of 2007, the Tax Division's Partnership Technical Resource Panel has provided several comments on the new information reporting requirements on Schedules B and K-1 and the related instructions. We will continue to work with the IRS to try and change the requirements and will keep you informed in future e-alerts. Also, the IRS is posting information on this issue at its website. Later 1099-B forms and fiduciary return problems. Here's another problem for practitioners in the heart of busy season. As we reported earlier, the Energy Improvement and Extension Act of 2008 provided a February 15th instead of January 31st due date for institutions to provide their customers with Form 1099-Bs. This later date was negotiated by financial institutions as a concession for increased basis reporting requirements in the Act. IRS Notice 2009-11 implements this change and allows 2009 statements to be provided even later, by February 17th, because February 15th is Sunday and the 16th is President's Day. The later statements include 1099-Bs and also related composite statements from financial institutions with such information as dividends, interest, and original issue discount. This may provide more accurate 1099s and avoid some amended returns, but it compresses our workload and causes problems for estate trust distributions. The problem for fiduciary practitioners is that estates and trusts have just 65 days after year-end, that's by March 6, 2009 this year, to distribute 2008 distributable net income under Section 663B in order to avoid having income taxed at the generally higher trust rates. As you know, undistributable DNI is taxed at the entity level rather than at the individual level, and the fiduciary rates are higher at lower income levels. Trusts and estates and their advisors also have a shorter period in which to decide whether to file Form 1099-T, passing the trust's estimated tax payments to the beneficiaries under Section 643G2. This is because Form 1041-T is also due within 65 days after the end of the preceding taxable year. Thus, fiduciary practitioners will need to act quickly after getting the Form 1099-Bs and composite statements to consider whether to make these two elections on a timely basis. There are no extensions for these 65-day rules. Get ready, it's going to be a fast 2 weeks. IRS sets 2009 employee personal vehicle use values. RevProc 2009-12 revises the maximum value of vehicles for which cents per mile and the fleet average rules can be used to determine the value of an employee's personal use of a vehicle. That maximum allowable fair value is $15,000 for automobiles and $15,200 for trucks and vans. To use the fleet average valuation rule, the limit is $19,900 for all vehicles. Section 7216 practice guidance available. As we reported earlier, the final regulations on the unauthorized disclosure of tax return information under 7216 were published on December 30th. Practitioners are concerned about the breadth of these regulations, which carry potential criminal penalties. The Tax Center website contains practice support tools on Section 7216, including a practice guide with sample consent forms, an article on the regulations, and a chart of the regulations prepared by PricewaterhouseCoopers. The May issue of the Tax Advisor magazine will also include an article on the regulations, and it will reference the PwC chart in its footnote 49. Form 990PF checklist revised. From comments from practitioners, we recently revised the 2008 checklist for Form 990PF. Please download and use the updated document that can be accessed on the Checklist and Practice Guides page of the Resource section of the Tax Center website. The annual package of Tax Practice Guides and Checklist is over 600 pages in length and includes checklists for preparing and reviewing all major tax forms. These are available online for Tax Section members and can be found under the Resources tab at aicpa.org/tax. Bernie Madoff with your clients' funds. Clients who lost money in Bernie Madoff's alleged Ponzi scheme are asking about the tax consequences, and here's a brief discussion of some of the issues involved. This is important for those of you who have Bernie clients, but it's also interesting to the rest of us. Did your client have a capital loss? A capital loss isn't going to be much comfort with plenty of other losses and few recent gains to offset them with recently, and with a $3,000 per year limit on losses taken against other income that could take some of Bernie's clients centuries before they'll be able to recognize the full loss. Was it a theft loss? Investor statements generally described ownership in a participating fund and did not identify ownership in a specific security. So fraud might have been present from the very beginning. But taxpayers have to prove the amount of their losses, and a reasonable estimate may not be available for a while. A recent tax court memorandum case held that the burden of proof for a theft loss is on the taxpayer to establish that no reasonable prospect of recovery exists, and it may be too early to determine if SIPC will provide some coverage, if any assets will be recovered, or if commissions and fees might be recoverable from various financial advisors who received commissions for recommending Madoff investments. Was the prior income that has already been reported on returns real? Some prior year dividends, interest, and other income from distributions may not have been real, as they may have been paid out of other investors' contributions rather than being dividends and other such income as defined in the Internal Revenue Code. Some practitioners are planning on filing amended returns if for no other reason than to protect an expiring statute of limitations. However, until some determination is made that the dividends or other distributions were false, it's not possible to say what the IRS will do with these amended returns. Also, inconsistent positions in filing returns for refund of taxes paid might be a problem. If you request a refund for the years that are open under the statute, saying that the dividends never existed, how do you claim basis and thereby claim a theft loss for years that are closed? IRS guidance on this issue would be helpful to guide practitioners in their the approach to be taken. IRA, 401k, and other tax-deferred accounts that contain Bernie investments. These accounts may not be eligible for capital loss or theft loss tax benefits because they received an upfront deduction and they effectively have no basis in their accounts. IRS position on amended returns, no official position has been offered, but hopefully they'll provide some guidance before April 15th. Bonus depreciation election procedures. As part of the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, Congress enacted Section 168K4 to allow a corporation to waive claiming the 50% additional first-year depreciation and alternatively to increase its business credit limitation and alternative minimum tax credit. In October, the IRS issued RevProc 2008-65 that clarified the rules for making the election out of the bonus depreciation under Section 168K4, the property eligible for the election, and the computation of the amount by which the credit elections are made. RevProc 2009-16 supplements this information by providing details of the time and manner for making the election. The election must be made by the due date, including extensions, of the federal tax return for the year ending after March 31, 2008. To preserve the election for future years, a taxpayer must make the election even if it did not place any eligible property in service during the year. The election only applies to new property placed in service between March 31, 2008 and January 1, 2009. The RevProc also provides guidance for making allocations of the credit limitation increases allowed by the election among members of a controlled group. It also covers the effect of the election on partnerships with corporate partners that make the election, and also guidance on how an S corporation can obtain a benefit under Section 168K4 if it is subject to the built-in gains tax and is also allowed a credit for research or AMT credits that arose in a prior period when it was a C corporation. Deciding whether to preserve the election for future years may be an important issue for some corporations, especially in these times where corporations are seeing losses and Congress is considering increasing the NOL carryback period from 2 to 5 years. A close read of RevProc 2009-16 would be advisable. It should be posted to the IRS.gov website within the next few days. IRS issues several pieces of guidance under Section 409A and 457A. The IRS recently issued several pieces of guidance on 409A deferred compensation. The first is proposed regulations explaining how to calculate the amounts, including penalties, that should be included in income when a non-qualified deferred compensation plan does not comply with Section 409A. These regulations are generally effective for taxable years beginning on or after the issuance of the final regulations. The second is Notice 2008-113. Which furnishes methods for limited corrections or limited inclusions for certain non-qualified deferred compensation plan operational failures. The notice does not provide any mechanism for correcting an error in the plan in the way the plan was written. The third is Notice 2008-115, which gives transition guidance on reporting and wage withholding under Section 409A, and describes a mandatory income inclusion calculation for years prior to the regulations becoming effective. This guidance is effective for 2008 and will be valid until further guidance is issued. In addition, the IRS has issued Notice 2009-8, which gives transition guidance on new Section 457A. Although there are still many unanswered questions, the notice includes an explanation of which plans are covered by this new code section by describing the plan sponsor and whether it is a non-qualified entity subject to non-qualified deferred compensation. Allocating the first-time homebuyer's credit for non-married co-owners. IRS Notice 2009-12 provides examples of how to allocate the first-time homebuyer's credit under Code Section 36 between non-married co-purchasers. Generally, any reasonable method is acceptable for allocating this question, which may be claimed on Form 5404, which is filed with your 2008 or 2009 federal tax return. This credit was included in the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008 and operates like an interest-free loan because it has to be repaid over 15 years. Subpart F manufacturing regs are issued by the IRS. In late December, the IRS issued final, temporary, and revised proposed regulations on contract manufacturing. The final regulations define manufacturing and cover the Subpart F foreign-based company sales income rules and how they apply to controlled foreign corporations that hire contract manufacturers. That's a term of art in quotes, contract manufacturers. The temporary regs adopt, with modifications, proposed changes to the branch rules and affect CFCs that conduct business selling, purchasing, or manufacturing operations outside the country of incorporation. According to an IRS official, taxpayers do not need to meet every activity in a factor list to get credit for that factor in applying the substantial contribution test of the recently issued contract manufacturing regulations. These new regulations, which revise the proposed effective date, generally apply to CFC taxable years beginning after June 30, 2009. Temporary regulations will expire on or before December 31, 2011. Taxpayers generally are allowed to apply the final and temporary regulations in their entirety retroactively to all open years. We will be submitting comments on the temporary regulations that are due on March 30th. So if you want to pass along your thoughts, please send them to Eileen Scher at her email address, escher@aicpa.org. That's escher@aicpa.org. U.S.-based multinational companies that sell products overseas should review their structures in light of these new temporary and proposed regulations, as it might result in possible new opportunities and reduced risks. Representing your interest. The GAO is studying information reporting on cash charitable contributions for the Senate Finance Committee. Officials for the Government Accounting Office discussed compliance issues in reporting charitable contributions with the Tax Division's Individual Income Tax Technical Resource Panel. The GAO is seeking information from stakeholders as to how charities would react to reporting of information on individual taxpayers' cash charitable contributions. The Tax Division panel responded that Form 1099 reports cash contributions would, if implemented, increase the burden on taxpayers, practitioners, and charities, both large and small, software developers, and even the IRS. Also, the group did not believe that the tax gap would be significantly reduced by such information reporting. The GAO stated that it was on a fact-finding mission only and that no such work was in process. Hey, there's a $100 discount for tax section members on attending the AICPA conference on tax strategies for high-income individuals. With the economy in turmoil and a new president and Congress promising change, you need to keep up. This is one of the purposes of this AICPA conference on tax strategies for high-income individuals, where SIDCAS has assembled a panel of leading experts to offer insights into the hottest current tax issues, including opportunities and risks in investments, real estate tax strategies, IRS enforcement priorities, and post-election changes in planning. You can get more information and register online at cpadedbiz.com. And again, as a tax section member, you'll receive a $100 discount for the program. That's it for this report. And it was based on the work of our tax team in the AICPA Washington office. I hope it has been helpful, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AICPA Tax Section Podcast. Join the tax section and receive emailed alerts with links to many of the source documents referenced in this podcast. And be sure to tune in next time for even more coverage of all things tax and tax related.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA makes no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assumes no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and expressly disclaims all liability for such damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.